listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and happy Friday. Senator Sanders will be with us in just a moment. We're trying to track him down. He's on the road, and we had a bum phone number for his hotel, so Danielle is on it. And any second now, he should be joining us. Dr. Eric Court is going to be with us in our second hour. He's a professor with NASA. I'm talking about methane and the gas that could end the world. And Senator Sanders is on the line. Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome, Senator.
Good to be with you, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? What's on your mind and what's happening in the world?
I'm calling you from the San Francisco area. We had a wonderful meeting last night in Richmond, California, outside of San Francisco. Chevron is putting about $3 million into a campaign against progressive candidates, and we had a huge standing room only crowd ready to fight back, and that was pretty good.
That is great. That is great.
And tonight we're going to be speaking in San Francisco at the Unitarian Church at 1187 Franklin Street, the corner of Geary Boulevard at 7 p.m., and folks want to come out, we would appreciate that.
I've been there. That's a great venue.
Good. What I think is going on, you know, I think there's a lot that is going on, and I think politically people are wondering who is going to be controlling the United States Senate and whether right-wing Republicans will be able to control the entire United States Congress. And I think, Tom, what's going on is there is a lot of discontent in the country for good reason. People are hurting economically. People are worried about what's going to happen to their kids. Will their kids get decent jobs, be able to afford to go to school? The Affordable Care Act has helped some, but we still have 40 million people without any health insurance. Many others are paying high deductibles and co-payments. People worried about the international situation. The newspapers today, every day, are filled up with Ebola, and people are frightened about that. And I think what the Republicans have done very, very successfully is, with their huge amounts of money and the Koch brothers behind them, is to say to people, are you happy? Are you content with where we are as a nation today and where we're going? And overwhelmingly, people say no. And then when the Republicans say, well, if you're not content with Obama, and you're not content with all those people who support Obama, then clearly you want to change. Vote Republican. Well, that makes sense for about 2 seconds until you think about the implications. And the implications are, what are the Republicans offering to make the situation better? Do people really think more tax breaks for the rich when the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well and doing better than perhaps any time in American history? Do we really think that that's what we need? Do we think we need more tax breaks for large multinational corporations when, in fact, corporate America is paying substantially less collectively into the federal treasury than they did in previous years, less than 10%? Do we really think that a tax on Social Security, which is what the Republicans will mount, or ending Medicare as we know it, is a solution to the current problems that we face? What about cutting back on food stamps and nutrition programs or affordable housing? So the point is, what the Republicans have done, and their strategy is pretty smart, I would say, is they rip Obama apart from one end to the other, and they spend huge amounts of money doing that. And then what they do is they attack any Democratic candidate who has voted with Obama. Most of them, and so what they say is, if you don't like Obama, you don't like this candidate, vote Republican. But I would ask people just to take a hard look at the Republican agenda and see if that's an agenda that you're comfortable with. And I would also ask people, go to my website, sanders.senate.gov. We have the information. The Koch brothers in this campaign, Tom, we don't know how much they're going to spend because a lot of their money is what we call dark money. It's under-the-table money. It's non-disclosed money. But the guess is that it may be, you know, $300-$500 million. This is the second wealthiest family in the country, worth $85 billion. prepared to spend $300-500 million to allow right-wing Republicans to take over the U.S. Senate and the Congress. What do these guys stand for? And that's important to know because the media has done a very bad job in telling us what they stand for. One would think that one would want to know what these guys have in mind. And let me just read some of what their ideas are. And this is based on a 1980 campaign that David Koch, who was one of the Koch brothers, mounted when he ran for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian Party ticket. And their views have not changed. This is what they believe in. We favor the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid programs. They want to not cut Medicare and Medicaid. They want to get rid of it. People think that's a pretty good idea. Quote, we favor the repeal of the fraudulent, virtually bankrupt, and increasingly oppressive Social Security system. I'm not talking about cutting Social Security. They want to get rid of Social Security. I know on this program, Tom, we get calls very often from people who are concerned about what's going on in the Postal Service. The Postal Service is one of the more popular and important governmental agencies. This is what the Koch brothers say about that. They say that we propose the abolition of the governmental postal service. Gone. No more postal service. Right now, as you know, we are fighting to raise the minimum wage because the $7.25 federal minimum wage of today is a starvation wage. We've got to raise it. We have a bill on the floor for $10.10 an hour. I would go further than that. It's a start. Raising the minimum wage will give a pay raise to about 25 million Americans. This is what the Koch brothers say about the minimum wage. Quote, we support repeal of all law which impede the ability of any person to find employment, such as minimum wage laws, end of quote. In other words, their view is not that we should not raise the minimum wage. They think we should get rid of the minimum wage so that if in a high unemployment area in tough times, desperate people are forced to work for $3 an hour, that's fine. That's good. That's their understanding of freedom. Let me give you another plank in their platform. Quote, we advocate the complete separation of education and state. Government schools lead to the indoctrination of children and interfere with the free choice of individuals, end of quote. You know what that means, Tom?
Yeah. No more free schools
in America. Government, they further say government ownership, operation, regulation, and subsidy of schools and colleges should be ended. There goes the entire National University, University of California, University of Vermont. Government should not be subsidizing colleges. And if you have the money, well, that's great. You send your kid to a private school. So this is the agenda. It is an extreme right-wing agenda of the second wealthiest family in America, who are waging an all-out war against working families who are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars to support right-wing candidates. Now, what goes on is when you turn on your TV tonight, you hear a barrage of TV ads. None of the Republican candidates, or the ads supporting Republican candidates, are going to say, vote for candidate X. He will cut your Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and nutrition programs and give huge tax breaks to the wealthy and large corporations. That probably will not be in a 30-second ad you'll see tonight. That is the agenda. And what they then do is they come up with issues that they think, wedge issues that they think will resonate with the American people. So these are tough times, and there is no debate that we have got to do a lot more for the economy. But going back to Bush's trickle-down economic theory ain't going to help.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour with Senator Bernie Sanders, who's on the road today. He's in San Francisco, and you can get all the details of his schedule and where he's appearing and whatnot over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be back with your questions for Bernie right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Nate in Boring, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air, Senator Sanders. Excuse me.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Sanders, where can I go to read the administrative rules in regards to veterans benefits? Because when I go to the website, it's like a big loop, and I just keep going around in circles. And when I call them, I've talked to over a dozen different people, and none of them will give me an answer.
So you're having a problem with veterans' issues and you're not getting an answer.
Well, I want to read the administrative rules for my father, and he has conservatorship. I just want to make sure that
okay.
the conservator is playing
the rules. Here's what you
rules.
Can do. You can, first of all, call up your U.S. Senator's office, Ron Wyden, or Jeff
Merkley.
Merkley will be there to help you. If not, give the U.S. Senate, the Veterans, U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committee a ring, and we'll get you that information. Okay, just it's in D.C. Go to our website, U.S. Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Give us a ring, and we'll get you that information.
Okay, great. Florence in Tenino, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi there. I'm working with my postmistress, and she's very worried that they're closing processing facilities locally and all over the country,
yep.
and they plan to stop overnight first-class intercity mail. What can we do? Is the president going to be electing new board, post office board members? Because aren't they the ones who elect the new postmaster general?
Well, the postmaster general, to the best of my knowledge, is Mr. Donahue, and he is there. You're right. You're absolutely right. He is proposing the elimination of 82 processing plants. These are the plants that process mail and send it out to customers. We are working very hard to stop the closing of those plants. And, in fact, this is a rare instance where actually we have some Republican support. And I think we now have over a majority, over 50, I think we have 51 senators on board already who are in opposition to the closing of those plants. So during the lame duck session, when Congress reconvenes, we are going to work as hard as we can to prevent those closings.
Okay. And Brian in Matthews, North Carolina. We have just 1 minute to the break, Brian. Quick question for Brian.
Yes, good afternoon, Professor and Senator. How are you guys today?
Good.
Quick question. I just want you guys, if you can, to elaborate to your audience. Is there some sort of psyche or some sort of mindset in this country to where we continuously, I mean, time after time again, each election cycle, we vote against our own interests, even with evidentiary facts presented before them. We get nothing out of those people whatsoever for voting for them. Why do we continuously? Why? Please elaborate.
Okay, well, that's a very good question. And the answer has something to do with the fact that political scientists tell us that in this election, in a couple of weeks, probably 60% of the American people won't vote. And of the 60% who won't vote, probably 75-80% of low-income workers, the people who are struggling at $9 or $10 an hour, won't vote, and probably an equal number, 70-80% of young people won't vote. So the people whose lives, future lives, were young, depend upon governmental action and what happens to Congress, they're not going to vote, and the people who are struggling the most economically are not going to vote. And the reason for that, there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think...
Let's pick that up in just a second, Senator. Hang on. We'll be right back. With us, it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator Sanders is in San Francisco right now, where he's going to be holding a gig. Where and when again is that, Senator?
It's going to be at the Unitarian Church, 1187 Franklin Street on the corner of Geary Boulevard, 7 p.m.
And that's tonight?
That's tonight.
Okay, great. Let's see here.
We were on a call with Brian from North Carolina, I think.
Yeah. And
Brian asked a pretty good question.
Go for it.
Very good question. That is, why do people keep voting against their own best economic interest? And I think it's a question that we could use a very long period of time to answer, but it has to do with what has been created in this country, not by accident, is the belief, if you're a working person, if you're a young person, why would you want to be involved in the political process? Why would you be wanting to vote? It's all irrelevant. They're all crooks. They're all idiots. Don't waste your time. Don't vote. And that's the mentality that is pushed out there. Politics is not important. It's just dumb people and corrupt people and everything else. Meanwhile, the Koch brothers don't think it's irrelevant. they're spending $400 million on this election because they understand that who controls the United States Congress and the White House, that decision will impact the lives of every person in this country. But how you change that culture just is not easy. But I think that is a significant reason as to why we end up seeing people get elected who are working night and day against the best interest of working families.
Gary in Wheaton, Illinois, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
So with the Citizens United, money equals speech. Does bribery become legal then at that point?
Yes, it does, as a matter of fact, Gary. That's a good question. Of course it is. That's what we're talking about. Now, you know, what the Supreme Court says, if somebody were to give me a $10 bill to say, vote for this thing, and I voted for that thing, my God, I am just guilty of bribery. That's bribery. But if somebody puts $50 million into somebody's campaign to enable that person to win, that's not bribery, you see, because that's not direct. They didn't give money directly to that person. That's totally absurd. What you have right now, and Gary asked, again, a very important question. What you have right now, in my view, is a Congress that will not pass legislation, any legislation or any significant legislation that is opposed by corporate America or Wall Street, because these guys fund the campaigns and candidates and elected officials are not going to bite the hand that feeds them. So if the Koch brothers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars and are telling people, you know what, we are in the fossil fuel industry. We're making a huge amount of money by the production and distribution of fossil fuel, and your point of view is climate change is not real. It's a hoax. Okay, thank you. Climate change is a hoax. We got it. And your point of view is that we're not going to raise the minimum wage. In fact, we may want to abolish the minimum wage. Okay, we got it. That's a good idea. Is this bribery? No. Now, technically, no one is giving a candidate money to put in his pocket. But for all intents and purposes, what you have increasingly, and it was bad before, Citizens United has made it much, much worse, is a system today where elected officials are beholden to big money interests and will do what big money interests want.
Ben, in Miami, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. The investigation that you're doing with Representative Cummings with regard to the prescription drug price increases on the generic drugs,
yes.
Are you concerned, how concerned are you about, as far as the Medicare Part D, that these increases are going to force seniors much faster into the coverage gap and the over the next 6 years before the coverage gap is eliminated,
that's a great cost-sharing
That took place, you know, the cost sharing figured
let's
out.
Let's let Bernie answer that, Ben.
Right, Ben, that's a great question. And here's what the issue is, in case people are not familiar with it. Representative Elijah Cummings in the House and I are doing an investigation regarding the huge, and by huge I mean huge, increase in prices for a number of generic drugs. The theory behind generics is that they will drive prescription costs down because the formula for the drug is now on the market. It's not owned by the company that developed the drug. And that in many ways has happened over the years. Generics have been a very important process in lowering the cost of prescription drugs for millions of Americans. But what Cummings and I noticed recently, that in the last year, a number of generic drugs have gone up not by 3%, not by 20%, not by 100%, but in some cases prices have gone up by 10 times. So drugs that used to be pretty inexpensive are now extremely expensive. What we have done is written to all of the drug companies who have dramatically raised their prices, demanded an answer. We'll be in all likelihood, if we have the time when we get back, doing a hearing on this issue. Drug prices are hurting, the high cost of drugs is just hurting millions of Americans, and we have to understand why these prices are going up, and we got to do everything we can to lower them.
We'll be back with Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right after this.
You're You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if you're in the San Francisco area, Bernie will be at the Unitarian Church on Geary Street tonight in San Francisco at 7 p.m. Be sure to drop by and say hi. Here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us live from San Francisco, where tonight he'll be at the Unitarian Church on Geary Street at 7 p.m. And, Senator, you're still here, right?
I am right here.
Okay, great. Kelly in Los Angeles, speaking of California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Senator Sanders, I was wondering, do you think that the fact that for the first time in a long, long time, none of our justices has any experience in electoral politics, either ever running for public office or ever running a campaign for public office, kind of informed their fantastical ruling in Citizens United and some of these other rulings they've handed down?
Well, Kelly, I think that's a good point, and I think that is perhaps one of the reasons that these guys voted the way they did in a 5-4 decision, by the way, on Citizens United, but I don't think it's the major reason. I think what the Koch brothers and other right-wing extremist billionaires have managed to do is create a political climate over the last 30 or 40 years at every level of society, which has enabled Republican presidents to put forward very right-wing members of the court who have a philosophy that what freedom is about is the elimination of important governmental programs. The idea that anybody could believe that allowing a family like the Koch brothers to spend hundreds of millions of dollars is not going to have a huge impact on the democratic political system that we have is, I would, you know, your point is that they're kind of naive, they don't understand how it works. I think you're being a little bit kind. I think they do understand how it works. And I think their understanding is that it is a really good idea for the billionaire class to control not only the economy of America, but the political processes. I've mentioned several times on this show, in 1980, when David Koch ran for vice president of the United States, one of the important planks that he ran on the Libertarian Party, was the elimination of the Federal Election Commission and all campaign finance laws. And by the way, guys, if you think that Citizens United is the end goal of where the Republicans want to go, you're wrong. They want to get rid of all campaign finance law, so that the billionaires can give money directly, not through independent expenditures, but directly to the candidates. So they will totally own the candidates.
Take us right back to 1985.
Kelly, your point is interesting, but I think the deeper point is these guys work for big money.
John in Boise, Idaho. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I got a question for you. Should we go back to what it was like five or six years ago when Democrats were in control and people on Social Security weren't getting raises, their yearly raises?
John,
what's your question?
Should we go back to like what it was for 5 or 6 years ago?
John is using a speakerphone, Senator. I think what he's saying is...
John, is your point that we went through several years where there were no cost of living adjustments for Social Security?
And he's saying that during that time, Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House. The Democrats were in control of Congress.
The answer is Nancy Pelosi or Barack Obama doesn't make that determination. It's based on a formulation having to do with inflation. And if the determination is that inflation is 4 or 5%, people get 4 or 5% COLAs. There were a couple of years where the determination was there was a zero increase in inflation. Now, there were two points that I would make. If my friend John was worried about that, then he should be very worried that the Republicans and some Democrats, I'm not going to deny there's some Democrats, but virtually every Republican
is supportive of a concept called the chain CPI, John. And what that would do is change the formula so that seniors and people with disabilities would get smaller cost of living increases than the current formulation. So if you like that idea, John, that regardless of what the inflation may be in a given year, it would be less under this chain CPI supported by virtually every Republican. Second point, when John talks about going back 6 years, I think it's a fair question above and beyond the Social Security issue. And that is, let's do it, John. And let's just say that we went back 6 years. You know where we were 6 years ago at this time? Right about this time. What was going on, Tom? What was going on is we were worried whether the financial system of the United States would, in fact, survive. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
We were worried whether, in fact, when people put their credit card into an ATM, any money would come out. We were worried about whether the world's financial system would collapse and we would end up in the worst depression maybe in the history, modern history of the world. That's where we were 6 years ago. And a lot of that had to do with the deregulation of financial institutions supported by Republicans and Democrats. But a lot of it also had to do with the Bush administration looking the other way. How could it happen? How could it possibly happen that we moved into this horrendous financial crisis so that one day the Secretary of Treasury says, Bush's Secretary of Treasury says to the Congress, hey, you better come up with $700 billion, or we may not have a financial system. Where was the Bush administration? And if you want to look back 6 years ago, what about a war in Iraq that this country never should have gotten into, which in many ways created the horrible can of worms that we are in right now in the Middle East with destabilizing the entire region, not to mention between Afghanistan and Iraq, the loss of almost 7,000 American soldiers, many hundreds of thousands coming back with PTSD and TBI, a cost of between $3 and $6 trillion. Those are the wars that we got into, John. So you want to go back to that period? You want to go back to trickle-down economics, where despite huge income and wealth disparity, Bush and his friends gave huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country? So here's the point. I have been more critical of Barack Obama than probably anybody in the Democratic caucus. I am an independent. I caucus with the Democrats. I think Obama has not been as strong as he should be on many, many, many issues. But to suggest that going back to the Bush era ideology of more tax breaks for the rich, and John raises the issue of Social Security. John, if you think that Obama has not been strong on Social Security, that's fine. But it was Bush who wanted to privatize Social Security. You think that's a great idea? So I think, you know, this gets back to the point that I made initially in the program today, Tom. People are hurting. And John's point is relevant. People are hurting. They're worried about Social Security. They're worried about a lot of things. But if you think going back to the trickle-down economic theory, which benefits the rich and large corporations, the guys who want to privatize Social Security, who want to end Medicare as we know it, massive cuts in Medicaid, who want to eliminate the concept of the minimum wage, who want to appoint more right-wing Republicans into the Supreme Court. If you think that's a good thing for the future of America, I would strongly disagree with you.
Jason in Washington, D.C., you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, I'm so glad you were talking about bribery. When Hillary Clinton gets out of office and she gives a $100,000 per speech thing to the National Realtors Association and the International Recycling Association, is that a bribe?
It's not good stuff. It's not good stuff. I mean, you know, technically it's obviously different than a campaign, you know, contribution going into a campaign. But why these organizations pay people that astronomical sum of money for a couple of hours' speech is beyond my comprehension, and it makes no sense to me at all. It's wrong.
Terry, in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on 880 AM, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Ohio at one point had an election where the ballots were diverted to a basement in Kentucky. And my question is, how are we securing that these are going to be honest elections when we have all these hackings into big companies? And should we go back to paper ballots?
Well, it's an issue that Tom and I have discussed many, many times. And I think there is concern about voting machines. I think maybe that's the most important aspect of the issue, and whether these voting machines can in fact be manipulated. And Tom, I think you have studied the issue,
yeah.
And I think your judgment is that.
My concern is even a philosophical one, Senator, and that is that of all the things that we should not privatize, the thing that is the instrument by which we the people tell our elected representatives how to manage all the rest of the commons is our vote. It should be the last thing we privatize, not the first. Private corporations should not be running our vote.
Giving them over to private companies who run the provide the voting machines.
Right.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, if my memory is correct, in Canada, I live an hour away from the Canadian border, these guys do paper ballots. They have forever. No one questions the accuracy of their results. They have a paper trail. The ballots are sitting right there. And they get the results out pretty quickly. So I would tend to agree with the caller. I have no problem in suggesting that we go back to the old-fashioned paper ballots. We store them effectively. And if there's a recount that's necessary, you have the paper right there.
Yeah. Ireland just recently tried voting machines and then sold them for scrap metal, literally. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here, our National Town Hall meeting on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders in just a moment. If you're in the San Francisco area, Bernie will be speaking tonight at the Unitarian Church on Geary Street at 7 p.m. Get thee down there. You can learn all about it over at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in addition to his main website at Sanders.Senate.gov, you can find a very substantial presence for Senator Sanders over on Facebook and his Twitter feed. Be sure to check those out. And welcome back. Paul, watching Free Speech TV in South Lyon, Michigan. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, gentlemen. Senator, it never gets pointed out that the Republican plan to privatize Social Security, which doesn't sound too bad, actually ends the lifetime payouts, because when the money in your account runs out in 2 years, you're done. No more Social Security. You know, it's either get a job or become homeless. Isn't that the real Republican plan for Social Security?
Well, the real Republican plan is to end Social Security because it is a very effective program in cutting back substantially on poverty among seniors. What I can tell you is that before Social Security, about half the seniors in this country lived in poverty. Today, while the number is too high, that number is about 10%. So over the years, we have made significant progress in reducing senior poverty as a result of Social Security. What the Republicans want people to do is to not put money into Social Security, which is the case right now. We put 6.2% of our incomes into Social Security, and it's matched by our employer. What they would like us to do is invest in Wall Street, in the stock market. And I think that is a pretty dumb idea. I think if people want to invest in the stock market, that's great. But that is a very volatile market. I think what Social Security has done is guaranteed benefits for every single person in the program throughout the history of the program. So if you are interested in investments, go to Wall Street. Maybe you'll win, maybe you'll lose. If you are interested in a social insurance program, to be absolutely 100% sure that money is going to be there when you knew it, need it, that's what Social Security is about. And throughout the history of the Social Security program, not one person in any year has not gotten every benefit to which he or she is entitled to. That's a pretty good record, and that is why Social Security is very, very popular, and it's why people support it. Again, what the Republicans would rather do is give the program over to Wall Street, where the financial institutions can make huge amounts of money on commissions and in other ways.
Excuse me, Marty in Monroe, North Carolina. We have 1 minute to the break, Marty. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing, sir?
Good.
I'm very much a constitutionalist. When is this country going to get back to being operated and ran by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It seems like we're losing our Bill of Rights, our First Amendment, Second Amendment, Fourth, Fifth, Eighth, Seventh, and Eighth. When is the government going to get their heads out of their rear ends and realize that they are elected by the population to serve the population, not corporate America?
Well, in terms of the latter part of your question, when are elected officials going to understand their job is to serve ordinary people and not corporate America, I think that that will not happen until we overturn this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision and go to public funding of elections. Look, it just is not complicated. If I'm giving you, if I'm a large corporation and I'm funding your campaign, by and large, you're going to be beholden to me. So until we get money, big money, out of politics, we're going to continue that situation.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back to our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, with Senator Bernie Sanders. He is today live in San Francisco. He's going to be speaking tonight at the Unitarian Church on Geary Street at 7 p.m. in San Francisco. So if you're in the neighborhood, get on down and say hi. John, in Port Isabel, Texas, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. How you all doing?
Good.
Good.
Hey, listen, I'm a disabled vet, 100%. I discussed with you earlier about the voucher system.
Yep.
And I think if you think the voucher system's working, you're being misled and misinformed.
Nope, I don't. No, I'm not a favor of the voucher system, Joe. But go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I had, luckily my wife had Blue Cross from a school district she worked with, and I was able to use that. Because the voucher system at the VA here, which is actually the worst clinic in the country, just dropped the ball. I mean, it's not timely. You know, it's I hate to walk away from the VA system because I love my fellow vets, but you know, something's got to be done here, brother.
Okay, John. Thanks for the call and thank you very much for your service. And a couple of words on the VA and those vets like John who are disabled vets. When we talk about Social Security and the chain CPI, one of the aspects of that approach that has not been talked about enough is that would also cut benefits for disabled vets. Can you imagine that? Coming up with an idea that would cut benefits for disabled veterans. John, what we did in the recent legislation is to understand that one of the major problems in the VA is the fact that in many hospitals and clinics around the country, we simply don't have enough doctors and nurses and other medical personnel. In the legislation I fought for and succeeded in getting in, some $5 billion to hire more doctors and nurses. And just last week, we had the new secretary of the VA, Bob McDonald, with me in Burlington, Vermont, and down in Hanover, New Hampshire, to talk to students at the University of Vermont Medical School, one of the very, very fine medical schools in this country, and then at Dartmouth Medical School, another great medical school, getting them interested in serving with the VA, not only doctors, but nurses and other medical personnel as well. So the goal right here is long-term to strengthen the VA. Right now, John, I don't know what your experience has been, but for most of the veterans in Vermont and I think around the country, once they get into the VA, they feel pretty good about the quality of the care that they get. The problem that we have in a number of parts of the country is that the waiting lines were much too long and people were just not getting into the VA in a timely manner. We hope to address that. The VA is working aggressively now to lower those waiting periods around the country. I think they're doing a good job at that. But we hope to make sure that by hiring thousands of new doctors and nurses and other medical personnel, we will not see those waiting lines appear again. That's the goal.
Natalie in Houston, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Tom and Senator Sanders.
Hey, Natalie.
Hello.
Yes, you mentioned that 60% of the population won't go vote.
Yep.
And I think that's because 60% or more of the population, their psyche is built on Bible cliches. And unfortunately, that's what the conservatives push. And they only plans A, B, and C for their lives is to let God take care of it. So I work in public transportation, been working in public transportation for 24 years, and I've heard all of this mess. Oh, don't go vote. Your vote don't count. Them people going to do what they want to do anyway. And we are fighting an uphill battle because they look at the poorest of us and the most downtrodden of us. And most people don't realize some of that's been socially engineered. We have lead in our water, lead in our pipes. Over 50 years of exposure to lead has led to dull brains, low IQs, severe aggressiveness, and all kind of things like that. So that psyche is there, it's built in, and people just continually vote against their own interests.
Well, thank you for your observations. I think what has happened is, and again, let me, I've made this point several times, but I'll make it again. For all of you who think, especially lower income people who may be listening, that politics is irrelevant, people are going to do what they want to do, it really doesn't matter who gets elected, then you ask yourself why the second wealthiest family in this country, the Koch brothers, are going to spend some $400 million on this campaign. They obviously, and these are smart guys, they think that politics matters. They think this election is very, very important because they have an agenda that they want to see implemented, and that agenda deals with cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, lowering the minimum wage, doing away with the Environmental Protection Agency. So they think politics is pretty important. Well, they think politics is pretty important so that the rich become even richer. So the corporations have more flexibility in shutting down plants in America and moving to China, so it is harder for workers to form unions. Well, if they think it's important, I would say that if you're a low-income worker, you might consider that it is pretty important as well.
Senator, we have just a minute till the end of the hour.
Okay, I think what I would just like to say is these are tough times for the country, economically and politically, internationally. People are upset. People are demoralized. But what we do not want to do, in my view, is make a bad situation much, much worse. Economically, there is no ifs, buts, and maybes that while we have many problems today, we are a hell of a lot better than we were 6 years ago when the economy was in free fall, when we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. People say, well, we're not growing enough jobs right now. Well, it's true. But growing a few hundred thousand jobs a month is a lot better than losing 700,000 jobs a month. Giving tax breaks to the rich and large corporations, which is what the Republicans' mantra is, what they believe, is not going to help the economy for working people. It will make the rich even richer. So I hope very much that people will get involved in the political process. They will get out, participate, and vote.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dr. Eric Kort is on the line with us, the assistant professor at the College of Engineering, Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Studies at the University of Michigan. He worked on the study with NASA that found some methane hotspots here in the United States. This is fascinating stuff. We have a link to his website, which is at aoss.engin.umich.edu, over at tomhartman.com. Dr. Kort, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us about, let's start out, what is methane and why should we care?
Sure. So methane is an important greenhouse gas, and it's of greatest interest and concern when we're trying to understand our current climate and where climate is headed in the future.
Okay, and what is what did this study find?
So in this study, we considered satellite observations over the U.S. for the time period from 2003 to 2009. And when we analyzed the data, what we found is that the highest amount of methane above average, the so-called methane anomaly, really appeared in this Four Corners region in the southwestern U.S., so where Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado all meet.
Mm-hmm. And what's producing that concentration of methane in that spot?
So it's a great question. So we see this high level of methane there, and it's indicative that there are likely high emissions. And so you start to study it. Now, from our observations, we see all of the methane, which is contributed from all sources in the area. When we start to look at this region, the Four Corners area, there's the geologic basin called the San Juan Basin, where there's been quite a lot of fossil fuel harvesting activities. There's quite a bit of natural gas, there's coal mining, and there's actually a lot of natural gas produced from coal bed methane. It's the largest coal bed methane production site in the U.S. So it seems likely that much of what we see is linked into those industries and the activities that are going there.
And what can we learn from this? What is the significance of that? Are we doing this in the wrong way? Why methane there and not anywhere else, or not so much anywhere else?
So there is methane elsewhere as well, right? So there are sources kind of throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. With this study, there's a couple of things. One is that it pioneers the use of space-based observations to identify and quantify regions that behave in unexpected ways. So we didn't know going in that this was a region we should look at, but we instead found that this was a region we should look at from space. And then this also ties into the fact that it appears in the U.S., and our study is just in Four Corners, but combined with other studies across the U.S., it appears that prior estimates of emissions from fossil fuel extraction activities have tended to be too low.
And so what do we do going forward as a consequence of this?
Well, so that's a great question. I don't have the answer to that. I mean, we're, as scientists, you know, what we're trying to do is trying to understand what the emissions are and how they're changing moving forward, and trying to develop better ways to observationally identify locations that are behaving in different ways so that we can then, as society, make better decisions about what we would want to do. I mean, one example is if we find a place that has higher emissions than expected, we could then maybe mitigate those in some way. Yeah. But that steps beyond into societal decisions.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing stuff. Dr. Eric Kort, assistant professor with the College of Engineering, Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Studies at the U of M, University of Michigan. Dr. Kort, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you for having me.
It's great talking with you, and I appreciate the information and the research that you're doing. Anything goes Friday here. There's something I wanted to share with you first, though. This just blew my mind. You know, a couple days ago, I shared some stories from the Financial Times with you, and I talked about how I'm not promoting the Financial Times, but it's interesting to read the rich people talking to the rich people. I was shocked. Well, shocked is the wrong word. I was saddened, shall we say, by an article in today's Financial Times. It's on the front page of the electronic edition, titled Janet Yellen Bemoans Rising U.S. Inequality. And the subtitle on the home page of the Financial Times talks about this shows her liberal bias. And I would say it shows that reality has a liberal bias, and Janet Yellen is... Ben Bernanke was sort of wide awake, but, you know, we had 20-some-odd years of Alan Greenspan, who was totally in a fog. I mean, he had been a Ayn Rand acolyte. She had initiated him into her cult back in 1956. When she died, he brought a 6-foot-tall flower arrangement in the shape of a dollar sign to her funeral. He was one of her students and her... on bended knee followers. We had a really, really grim time with the Fed there for 20 some odd years with Alan Greenspan. And now we have Janet Yellen. She was speaking at a conference in Boston yesterday, And she said, and this, the Robin Harding wrote this in Boston, this article for the Financial Times. And this is where it, she said, speaking at a conference in Boston, the Fed chairwoman said she was greatly concerned, Jenny Yellen's words, by rising income and wealth inequality, and asked whether it is compatible with American values. Okay, so far so good. Then Robin Harding writes, her remarks will delight the Democrats who championed her as Fed chair, but risk a backlash from Republicans who may feel she is using the platform of the central bank to promote the causes of their political rivals. I really don't believe that Janet Yellen is political. I think she is simply acknowledging the fact that wealth inequality, the concentration of wealth at the top, means that there is less wealth in the middle class and at the bottom. And it's the people in the middle class and at the bottom who are the job creators. They're the ones who spend all of their income on consumer goods, which somebody has to manufacture or grow or transport or package. And she gets that. Janet Yellen said, and I quote, "The extent of and continuing increase in inequality in the United States greatly concerns me. The past several decades have seen the most sustained rise in inequality since the 19th century, after more than 40 years of narrowing inequality following the Great Depression. I think it's appropriate to ask whether this trend is compatible with values rooted in our nation's history, among them the high values Americans have traditionally placed on equality of opportunity." And then she talked about four building blocks for economic opportunity: resources for children, affordable higher education, business ownership, and inheritances. But this is where it gets really strange. For example, the article in the Financial Times says Ms. Yellen did not draw a policy agenda, although the usual prescription on education is public investment. But Jenny Yellen said, you know, our schools are one of the things that are contributing to inequality, one of the traditional solutions to inequality. I mean, look at the GI Bill, giving millions of returning veterans to World War II a free college education. Anyhow, she also said that the number of small businesses, this is a path to wealth for the middle class. And she said that there are fewer and fewer of these. So the article in the Financial Times says, and I quote, "The answer to falling business startups is more contentious. One possibility is the trend reflects greater regulation." Bull. I mean, this is just complete nonsense. We don't have fewer small businesses because of greater government regulation. That's absolute and utter nonsense. We have a smaller number of small businesses, fewer small businesses starting up right now, because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and you now have entire industry sectors dominated by three or four or five companies, and the cost of entry, the cost to break into these marketplaces, is obscene. It's impossible. And they will squash you like a bug when you compete with them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So net, I'm reading in the Financial Times, you know, right-wing conservative Republican propaganda. It's very sad. It's very sad. You expect that in the Wall Street Journal. I didn't expect it in the Financial Times. And welcome back. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Get into Anything Goes Friday. PETA watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Goshen, New Hampshire. Hey, PETA, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I've just got a quick question for you. Since no government seems to want to send troops to defend the people of Kobani for political reasons, and also elections are coming up and they don't want their own citizens to be killed.
You're talking about this city and
government just sit down, put a few million dollars into a common pool and hire mercenaries.
You're talking about a city in Iraq?
In Syria.
In Syria. Uh-huh. Okay.
Or just to wipe out ISIS generally.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, oh God, what was it, 25 years ago, they got a bunch of, an African country, I can't remember which one, hired about 50 South African mercenaries to wipe out a bunch of rebels, of which there were probably 2,500, 3,000, and they did it. And these ISIS people are hardened fighters, mercenaries are hardened fighters.
Right.
So for unpopular campaigns against people who threaten the world, why not just take a route that doesn't really have too many political ramifications for people coming up for re-election?
If the people of that community or if the government of Syria or the people of Syria had hired those mercenaries, I would not disagree with your logic.
Okay.
The problem is that when anybody imposes a military solution on a political problem in any country, they haven't solved the underlying problem.
And well, this is where the United States and Britain and France are doing airstrikes on this town, which was within, you know, 100 kilometers of the Turkish border.
Right.
So a military solution has already been in place.
I know, and I think it's
they don't want to put boots on the ground. I completely understand that. Enough lives have been lost. Why not just pay people who do it for a living?
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting question. I am blithering here because I on the one hand, yes, it makes perfect sense. On the other hand, isn't it morally the same thing? I mean, it might be more popular in your country because your own soldiers are not involved, but aren't you putting human life at risk? I mean, isn't on the third hand, these people signed up for it.
Taking some doctor or some plumber from New Hampshire who's joined the National Guard,
yeah,
who is not a hardened, you know, fighter.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that.
It's these people do this. They have chosen to do this for a living.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think it's morally different.
Yeah, and defensible, arguably.
I think it's defensible, yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting one. I'm going to have to ponder that, PETA, over the weekend. I don't have a quick answer for it other than it, you know, I mean, you could say the same thing about why don't we just, you know, drop in a bunch of weapons, or why don't we do the airstrikes, or why don't we fill in the blank, any kind of military solution to what's ultimately a political and economic problem on the ground is not a long-term solution. On the other hand, you've got people who are going to be slaughtered. So what do? It's a tough one. PETA, thank you for the call and a very thought-provoking question. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman program. Coach Glenn in State College, Pennsylvania. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Well, I was watching the Paul Krugman interview on Charlie Rose, and I'm reading Naomi's book. I'm about a third of the way through now.
Whose book?
It's clear that we... Naomi's...
Naomi Klein's.
Changes everything.
Yeah.
Right. And it's clear that we... industrialized countries cannot maintain our standard of living, but we have to, you know, fix that while we raise the standard of living in the other countries without trashing our efforts over here. You know, it's got to balance out some way so that we can save the planet. And I don't really see how that can happen. And no one like Krugman is he still talking about growth when really growth economies cannot be the solution.
You can. It's a debatable point. I mean, if you are, for example, taking an entire country and its economy and transitioning it from energy based on fossils, on 300 million year old fossils, to energy based on contemporary sunlight, there's going to be a massive amount of growth associated with that transition. Just like, you know, the Industrial Revolution, when we first went to steam in the 1830s, when we went to oil in the 1890s. When we went to coal in a big way in the 1850s, you know, with railroads and whatnot, every one of these steps, coal was feeding the age of steam, too, in the 1830s. But every one of those steps, every one of those transitions from one energy source to another, you know, arguably before 1825 or thereabouts, we were principally using wood. You know, we were principally using contemporary sunlight. And that's what we need to end up going back to is contemporary sunlight, only instead of burning wood to get it, we can now put up solar panels and windmills. But that, you know, that could provide for what would, you know, on the balance sheet look like significant growth. Things would get smaller. Our footprint would get smaller. We'd be producing fewer carbon emissions. If we were to use diminished cost for energy to raise the standard of living of poor countries around the world by by going in and putting in solar panels and solarizing communities that right now literally are living on, you know, using twigs and small fires locally, denuding the land. I've seen this all across Africa, denuding the land to, you know, for fires, for cooking fires and for heat fires in the winter, and replace those with solar panels so that the land can regenerate on the one hand, and also on the other hand, the people can actually have a higher standard of living. You know, all those are good and positive things that involve actually growth. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, on the one hand, we know that, but then our politicians build in blockages to say, well, you can't create a local energy economy because that will interfere with China's selling solar panels or vice versa. That, you know, Naomi has page after page of how, on the one hand, we're saying one thing and doing the other culturally.
Sure.
How are we going to break the iron grip of those capitalists who, you know, in extraction industries, who are going to just keep selling until we burn up?
Well, there, what you're talking about is the lack of political will to, you know, to engage in that, those kind of transformations. And that lack of political will is a consequence of five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court deciding to turn America from a democracy into an oligarchy. You know, these five monarchies in our constitutional monarchy saying, yeah, billionaires should run the show. And therefore, we have this total lack of political will. So I would say step one, and I had a long conversation with Naomi on the air, but I've not yet read her book. But I would say step but I understand, you know, the need to recalibrate capitalism. That requires political process. And as long as the captains of industry, as long as the owners of capitalism in the United States and around the world hold as much political power as they do, and much of that political power in the United States is the direct consequence of Supreme Court decisions from 1976 Buckley right up through, you know, McCutcheon and Citizens United, as long as that's the case, we're in deep trouble. And that's why I think movetoamend.org's work is so important. Glenn, thank you for the call. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to speak about the credit rating agencies. It's kind of what's going on in my industry, oil and gas. One of the things that I've noticed now, and I've come to conclude, is the only movement we have is companies like Chesapeake or One Oak or Williams that actually own mineral rights that can get around the Fed and make their own financials. My mother has a trust, and her office at one time was candid with me and said, we do not know what AAA means. We know what they say it means. We know what it's supposed to mean, but we can't trust anything that we can't do our own due diligence on. And this is hurting industry all the way through. I wanted to say this to Senator Sanders and ask him, you know, what's going on with the Congress about reining in the ratings agencies.
Right. The problem is that the rating agencies are part of the bankster industrial complex, and they, again, are using Citizens United and McCutcheon to buy politicians and to buy our political process. So you're not seeing meaningful regulation. There was that brief moment, those 74 legislative days, when President Obama had a majority in both the House and a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And he got a lot of legislation passed during those 74 days. Him and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid accomplished a lot. And one of the things that they accomplished was re-regulating in a small way the banks, you know, the Consumer Protection Bureau, Dodd-Frank. But it's 10% of what needs to be done, David.
And this is really hurting our economy because
yes.
It makes it so that nobody can really trust what's going on.
I agree. And I would submit to you that that's exactly what the Republicans want. They want the economy to crash while Obama is president so that they can blame it on him. They're looking at what happened to Herbert Hoover.
Did you like my letter to Inhofe? Did you like my letter to Inhofe I sent you?
I can't say I saw it, David. I'm sorry. What did it say?
A question for Senator Inhofe.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'll have to check it out. David, thank you for the call. My spam filter is pretty rigorous. Anything that's political that's not coming from one of my contacts typically gets routed into spam. So I'm sorry if I missed that. The best way to communicate is to drop a message on Tom's blog on the homepage of our TomHartman.com website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
28 minutes past the hour. It looks like the person who might have been exposed to Ebola and is on the Carnival cruise ship down near Belize is not contagious. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on the place where smart people get their news. And time for our Fox News Alert.
Fearful and unbalanced.
News has never been softer.
The most distrusted name in news.
To be honest, I've never seen such dysfunction.
So, who is responsible for these outrages?
This is Fox So-Called News.
It's our Fox So-Called News report. Well, apparently, Keith Ablo is he's the Fox News resident psychiatrist, and he's going off about how, A, President Obama's affiliations, quote, are with Africa and not with us. He's their leader. In other words, he's a black guy in the White House. Hey. And then he goes on to say that Americans have Stockholm syndrome because President Obama, his name is very much like Osama and Hussein, he adds. This has got to be the result of Keith Ablo having grown up with the name Ablo. Hey, Keith, how about Ablo? I mean, can you just imagine what this guy went through when he was 10 years old, 13, 15? And so now he's talk about projection. And now he is diagnosing our president as affiliated as this is so sad. Why does Fox do it? Well, obviously we know why Fox does this. Brooks in Phoenix, Arizona, listening to KPHX. Hey Brooks, what's up?
Yeah, hi Tom. Hey, great to talk to you today.
Thank you.
I know Bernie's done, but I was thinking this morning, you know, the 60 to 70% of the people that are not voting, and how in much of the world that voting is a mandated thing, that it's required to vote. And what I was wondering was, could the Democrats support a type of a proposal that would make an income tax credit tied to verification that you have voted?
Hmm.
Encourage people to vote.
Yeah. The Democrats could propose that. The Republicans would say, the only people who care about income tax credits, small ones like this would presumably be $20, $50, $100, something like that. The only people who care about that are poor people. So you're trying to incentivize, you're trying to bribe poor people into voting. We won't stand for it. Right.
Of course, the Republicans would oppose this kind of a thing, but it would politically put them in a bad spot to oppose it as well.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think it would. I think that they would figure out a way to spin this. Theory, but I think the way to get more people to vote is to inform people about the consequences of not voting. And as Bernie said, you know, people who think that their vote doesn't matter, who think politics don't matter, they should look at the richest guys in the country, the Koch brothers. They're throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into elections because they know that politics matters. And we need to be sharing that message. It's just. The other thing is, without these Supreme Court decisions, starting with Buckley in 1976, there would not be this massive Republican infrastructure, this massive Republican wave, as it were, that's coming, because you wouldn't have hundreds of millions, billions of dollars being poured from the coffers of cranky billionaires and transnational corporations into the pockets and into the campaigns of Republicans. I mean, Republicans would be toast right now if there was parity, if you had both conservative and progressive voices in the media, if you had at similar levels, if you could strip some of the conservative money out of politics, there would be, as was the case in the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, the 1960s, you know, before this disastrous, the first decision in 1976, the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, and then on from there, where the Supreme Court, Lewis Powell, you know, writing the decision, coming to the conclusion that money is somehow speech. So Just the damage that the Supreme Court has done to this country, and now turning us into an oligarchy, essentially. I don't see a lot of change coming until really, really fundamental stuff has changed, and that's going to require the American people to wake up, and that's going to be a big challenge. Brooks, thanks for the call. In fact, the American people waking up, I mean, you look at, for example, fear versus logic. The Republicans, conservatives are masters of using fear. Be afraid, right? Back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they were telling white people, be afraid of black people, they want your jobs. Or be afraid of black men, they're going to rape your women. Or be afraid of, fill in the blanks. It's all this be afraid. And now the current one is, oh my God, it's Ebola. Republican legislators are saying, it's Africa, right? Like there's no racial subtext to that. It's Africa. We got to worry about Africa. West Africa, we travel bans. Now just think about this for a minute. Right now, because there's no travel ban on travel out of Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, because there are no travel bans, when people leave those countries and arrive here, we know who they are. They get their passports stamped. They don't use subterfuge. They don't go through second or third countries. They don't play the kind of games that you play. I used to know back in the day, back in the 70s and 80s when I was doing international relief work with Salem International. And we helped set up programs for abused kids in Israel, and we were looking at some of the Arab countries. We spent a fair amount of time in Egypt, ended up not setting anything up there. The program in Israel has a substantial component for Arab kids as well as Jewish kids, for Muslim kids. And I remember flying from Jerusalem into Cairo the week that Anwar Sadat was shot on Nefertiti Airlines, an airline that had no markings. In the airport, they had the flight number and the time of departure, but no name of the city that it was going to and no name, because Israel could not acknowledge that this was happening. This came out of Camp David. This must have been back in the 80s. I'd have to look back to, when was Anwar Sadat shot, because that was my mark for it. But I knew people who were doing business in both Egypt and Israel and other parts of the Middle East. And many of them had two passports. And in fact, for a while, I don't want to get into me, but what people would do is they would contact their passport agency and say, I lost my passport. I need a replacement. Get a replacement. And now you've got two passports. And when you go through Israel, you get the Israel stamp on your Israel passport. And when you go through Arab countries, you get the Arab country stamps. And I can tell you how consequential this is. I was in Uganda. I was in Kenya in 1980, I think it was, 79 or 80, waiting to get my visa to go into Uganda. And I had not been instructed by the – I later learned this. This local British guy who was in the New Stanley Hotel where I was staying, and we would sit down in the Thorn Tree Cafe and drink gin and tonics and have long conversations. He was this kind of the old British Raj, with the three-piece suit and the cane with the brass bird head on the top of it and the whole bit. And I couldn't figure out why every day I'd show up at the Ugandan embassy and every day they'd say, come back tomorrow. And all I wanted was the damn visa stamp, right? Every day they said, come back tomorrow. And so finally, I decided, I'm going to take a week off while I'm waiting, and I'm going to go to Mogadishu. And so I booked a flight on Saudi Arabian Airlines, and they gave me a little sticker to put on my suitcase with my name. You get these stickers from the airlines, right? You put your name on it in case your bag gets lost. And I stuck it on the bottom of my briefcase and forgot about it. And the next day, this old British guy says, if you want to get your visa into Uganda, you got to bribe the guy. You got to, you pass him a 20 or a 50, I forget what it was, and you'll get your stamp. And it turns out that there was a lot of truth to that. I'm hoping the statute of limitations on that is long past. And so I got into Uganda, and I never went to Mogadishu, and I never flew on Saudi Arabian Airlines. Fast forward about 5 years. I'm flying into Israel with that briefcase. Years earlier, forgot that on the bottom of the briefcase is a Saudi Arabian Airlines sticker. I get to the airport, going through Israeli security, in Tel Aviv, coming into the country. And the guy says, he's asking me questions. Who are you going to visit? What are you doing here? You know, what's going on? And I'm giving him answers. And then he says, when were you in Saudi Arabia? And I said, I've never been in Saudi Arabia. And he turns and he shouts, literally shouts at me, slams his hand down on my briefcase and shouts, liar! And I'm like, what? And he flips my briefcase over and there's that Saudi Arabian Airlines sticker. And he says, what's that? And I said, well, I didn't even remember, actually. It took me a minute to remember that 3 years earlier, I had planned on taking this, 2-day trip to Mogadishu just for some sightseeing because I couldn't get my visa into Uganda. But they kept me there for 3 hours. They took everything apart. They took my toothpaste tube and stuck straws in it. Everything got x-rayed. Everything. It was incredible. And this is what happens in many of these Middle Eastern countries if you show up with stamps in your passport indicating that you've been in the countries that hate them, whether it's Israel or Saudi Arabia. In fact, many of the Middle Eastern countries won't let you in with an Israeli stamp. So
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what happens if you put a travel ban on these Ebola countries is people will start getting around it, and then, just like they do like what I just described, and then you won't have track of them. And that's why a travel ban is a crazy thing. It's a genuinely crazy thing. We'll talk about that more. Sean in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. Am I saying that right, Sean?
Yes, Pawhuska, Oklahoma, and good afternoon, Mr. Hartman.
Hey, Sean. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV.
Oh, thank you so much for everything and your associates do.
Thank you.
From the bottom of my heart, thank you. Anything goes. This is a simple solution I have to improve highway safety and employ many people in this country nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And is to build a separate highway system for semis and shipping vehicles. The weight of these things are tearing up the roads, and the Band-Aid solutions are inconsistent nationwide. And I just want to ask everyone, how many times have you almost been killed by a passing speeding truck just by the, air vacuum?
Yeah.
So it could probably take at least a decade or two if done properly. But that's another story.
You're talking about a separate highway, not just a separate lane for trucks. Why not instead just build out our rail infrastructure?
Well, I think the railroad, the way they build railroads and our geography and topography, it's an accident to happen eventually with plate tectonics and such, if you just think about it, and all the earthquakes.
Well, you could argue that for highways too.
Yes, you could, but I just want to separate unfair advantage big trucks have against little cars, especially people driving little electric cars, and they're almost thrown off the highway when the trucks go over.
Well, I think you're always, as long as there are small towns that are not served by rail, you're always going to have trucks delivering things. And, we're just not going to get around that. But I think that we could probably pull a very significant percentage of the trucks that are on the road off the road. And now there's a whole separate discussion to be had with independent truckers about what you're going to do to their living. But I think that could happen. And CSX runs those ads on TV where they say we can move a ton of freight 400 miles on a gallon of fuel. They're right. I mean, it doesn't include getting up to speed, but they're right. Those diesel engines are hybrids. They've got giant batteries in them and things. They're very, very efficient. And so if the big mistake I think that we made, and we made it over the last 40 years, and much of it during the Reagan era, was privatizing our rails.
No kidding. I mean, it's self-evident. The facts are self-evident.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, I mean, Abe Lincoln built an...
Don't trust me. Just look at the facts.
Yeah. Abe Lincoln built an intercontinental railroad system, you know, to help supply war material for the Civil War and whatnot. And over the years, that was expanded and grown and then it got all privatized. Some of it had been privatized all along, but much of it got privatized over, you know, over the last 50 years. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, if you take Amtrak from Washington, D.C., I mean, you can take it all the way up to, used to be Montreal, now at least Vermont. It rarely goes over 60 miles an hour, and there are some stretches where it only goes 30 miles an hour. Why? Because Amtrak has to lease rail rights of way from private for-profit companies that are really only interested in freight, and they can run freight at a much lower speed. And they don't, you know, the speed is not such a big deal for them on freight. And that's nuts. I mean, we need to fix our rail infrastructure. We need to expand it. Sean, thanks for the call. The thought-provoking idea. 10 minutes before the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. There's Victoria Jones in the White House. Hey, Victoria, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
So what's going on in the White House on a Friday afternoon?
Well, right now, Josh Earnest, the spokesman, is giving his briefing, and he is being asked a lot of questions about Ronald Klain, who was the chief of staff to two vice presidents, also was a clerk to a Supreme Court justice, and is also a high-level Democratic operative, and is now the Ebola response coordinator.
In other words, the Republicans said we wanted an Ebola czar, and they got an Ebola czar, even after they beat up Obama so badly for his czars, starting with Van Jones being his energy czar, right?
Yes, and in fact, President Obama is being criticized by people like Daryl Issa for this appointment as well.
Well, of course. Daryl, you know, if President Obama chose broccoli over asparagus, Daryl Issa would figure out a conspiracy and criticize him for it.
Maybe.
Yeah.
He is known for his ability to handle high stakes and fast-moving political crises. He will be responsible for coordinating the government's overall response to the Ebola epidemic, including efforts to contain the virus in Africa and the response to its arrival in the United States. He'll report to Lisa Monaco, Obama's Homeland Security Advisor, and Susan Rice, his National Security Advisor. The White House officials are praising the work done by Rice and Monaco, but are saying that Klain would provide additional bandwidth.
Hmm. Very interesting. Has anybody brought up the name Barclay E. Burdan, B-E-R-D-A-N?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. This guy is the CEO of Texas Health Resources, THR, which did $3.85 billion in business last year, 8.3% operating margin, profit, runs the hospital down in Texas where the Ebola disaster has happened. And I'm just wondering why nobody's talking about the CEO. But anyway.
No, I haven't heard them talking about the CEO. They've talked to Dr. Donald Barker, who is the guy sort of in charge. And I thought it was very interesting that at the House hearing yesterday, Dr. Varga's testimony was basically by remote. He did not attend the hearing.
Right.
He stayed in Texas, presumably because he needed to be there. I found that odd. Why did he need to be so hands-on for just one day? I just thought this was brilliant by somebody that he was able to get out of testifying, because he said some interesting things in his testimony, including that they inadvertently gave out incorrect information,
right,
in an effort to be transparent. And he never says in the testimony what that incorrect information is. And, of course, he wasn't there to be examined about it. But last Friday, they did hire a global PR firm.
Huh. So he gave pre-recorded testimony? It wasn't like a Skype call?
Written testimony.
Huh. How about that?
Yes. And he, you would think, would be a key witness.
Just for the record, speaking of this possibly Ebola exposed lab worker who is on a cruise ship off the coast of Belize.
Yeah.
I read in the New York Times that this person, according to the ship's doctor, is showing no symptoms whatsoever. Don't worry, be happy. And on the other hand, I'm reading on a couple of right-wing websites, oh my God, the world's going to end! Which is it?
It's neither.
Okay.
It's neither. He apparently is showing no symptoms and has sort of self-quarantined, which was probably smart because otherwise you'd probably been thrown overboard,
yeah.
I think, by now, by somebody, but has self-quarantined for the duration. But he was coming to the end of the quarantine period. I mean, he had very few days left of the 21 days monitoring period, but some are saying that it wasn't smart to choose to go on the cruise.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a broad consensus about that. On the other hand, you get somebody who, you know, this cruise might be the vacation of their lifetime. They're not making a pile of money working for these hospitals that make hundreds of millions, billions of dollars for their investors and CEOs and whatnot, but not for the guys working in the lab. And, giving up that vacation that probably was paid for, you know, months ago and planned maybe even a year early. It's got to be a tough thing. So
indeed.
Anyway, what else is going on?
Janet Yellen, the chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, has given a very interesting speech to an audience of economists at a conference about inequality in Boston.
Yes.
Speech titled Perspectives on Inequality and Opportunity from the Survey of Consumer Finances. I'd like to read a couple of excerpts. The extent of and continuing increase in inequality in the United States greatly concern me. She noted that the distribution of income and wealth in the United States has been widening more or less steadily for several decades to a greater extent than in most advanced countries. And she suggested that such a trend unaddressed was contrary to the founding principles of the United States. I think it is appropriate to ask whether this trend is compatible with values rooted in our nation's history, among them the high value Americans have traditionally placed on equality of opportunity. And she cited four building blocks to build economic opportunity. They include more resources for children, affordable higher education, business ownership, and inheritances.
Yeah. Yeah. I went off on this in the first hour of the program, actually in the beginning of the second hour, because the Financial Times did an article about this and basically said Janet Yellen is being a liberal. And the reason why there aren't more small businesses, which was one of her four points, is because of too much government regulation. And we all know that there's not more small businesses because there's no ecological niches for them as a consequence of Reagan ending the enforcement of the Sherman Act. It's every industry sector is dominated by giant corporations who keep out small businesses. But, you know, what can you say? I was frankly shocked to see, you know, right-wing propaganda in the Financial Times.
It's surprising.
But yes, it is. Actually, I expect that in the Wall Street Journal, but that's why I quit reading the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times. Anyhow, Victoria Jones.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a great weekend, Victoria.
You too.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be right back with Anything Goes For.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Interesting op-ed over at nakedcapitalism.com by, I just want to say Yves, Y-V-E-S. How do you pronounce that name? Y-V-E-S? Shano knows. He's gone. Yves. Anyhow, he's here. This discussion with the BBC gives a damning picture of the performance of the supposedly best of all possible worlds, U.S. healthcare system, in dealing with Ebola. Points out that Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has treated thousands of people in West Africa with Ebola and has seen 16 medical workers contract the disease. This hospital in Dallas has treated just one patient and already has two sick healthcare staff. In other words, we're doing pretty poorly, and we're doing it here in the first world. Doctors Without Borders is doing it in Liberia. So then they look into Medicare's most recent ratings. This hospital was well below state and national averages on assessments of its emergency department. For instance, it took an average of 52 minutes for an emergency patient to be seen by a doctor or nurse, twice the state and national averages. And then they talk about who is doing well with regard to this hospital. And this is very interesting. This is the recipe for CEO disease, Eve says. The leadership of Texas Health Resources may, in fact, be very typical of that of large nonprofit hospital systems. THR is such a system. Mr. Doug Hawthorne is the CEO who retired in September of this year. And he said, and this article about him said, in 1997, Doug Hawthorne helped reshape the healthcare industry in North Texas by leading the creation of Texas Health Resources, an alliance of Presbyterian Healthcare Resources, Harris Methodist Health System, and Arlington Memorial Hospital. By 2014, with more than 22,000 employees and fully owned and joint venture operations, Texas Health is one of the largest care providers in North Texas. For its 2012 fiscal year, it had $3.7 billion in total operating revenue, $5.3 billion in total assets. And then Eves goes on to say, for leading this system, Mr. Hawthorne made a lot of money. 2012, his base salary was $1 million. His bonus was $1.1 million. That's a mind-boggling amount of money for a guy who's just running a hospital. And he's not a doctor. He has no direct patient care experience, no public health experience, no biomedical or clinical science experience. He's a bankster. He's a businessman. The current CEO of Texas Health Resources, Mr. Barclay E. Bearden, who's only been on the job since September 1st of this year, was also hailed by the System Board of Trustees for his unique leadership strengths. How much money he makes, but presumably it's well over $1 million. We have a broken healthcare system in this country. This should be a wake-up call, a huge wake-up call. And it should also be, you know, it should also point out to wealthy people, you can't hide from diseases. Franklin Roosevelt came from a rich family, and he had polio. He was in a wheelchair most of his life. He understood this stuff. But the Koch brothers think that, you know, they're going to be able to absolutely avoid having a plumber come by or somebody who's going to mow their lawn or do the flowers on their grounds or something who doesn't bring a disease with them. I mean, maybe they've got a company-owned, you know, city attached, you know, like Pullman had, like George Pullman had back in the late 19th century, where you get a company-owned store for your employees, or a company-owned town for your employees, company-owned store. But I doubt it. This is showing frankly, the just buck-naked stupidity of libertarian and conservative ideology when it comes to our commons, particularly our healthcare commons, and why every other developed country in the world, they have dealt with Ebola patients in Spain, they've dealt with Ebola patients in, I believe, in France. I don't have the list here, but there's a number of countries that have dealt with Ebola patients. Some have lived, some have died, but nobody has infected hospital staff. Then you send them off to some hospital in right-to-work-for-less state, Texas, Rick Perry's Texas. And surprise! Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom. I just wanted to make a few observations, and I want you to tell me what you think about them.
Okay.
Like, for instance, that lady who called saying that why can't we use mercenaries over in Iraq, you know, because ISIS is only a few thousand men. What? I don't even think it's 50,000 men.
Yeah.
But I think that ISIS is being used as a diversion for us to do what we wanted to do last year, which is bomb the Syrians and bomb Assad and remove Assad from power. ISIS is the perfect cover for that. Gin up fear about ISIS, which was created by the Gulf states, by the United States, by Israel. This is a creation of those countries. So gin up fear for ISIS and use that as a diversion while they get rid of Assad. That's just one thing. Another thing, for instance, this Ebola virus. The World Health Organization has come out with a bulletin saying that it's probably possible that Ebola can be spread through coughing, sneezing.
Yeah, if somebody spits particles on you, you're at risk. Although, I mean, look at what happened in Texas. Here you had this guy in this apartment building with his girlfriend, his fiance, and presumably they were sleeping in the same bed. I mean, this is the story that I've heard in the news. And a couple of kids, he was in close contact with these people while he was in the early stages of being infectious. And it seems that none of them have gotten sick and were well past the quarantine period, you know, unless somebody's hiding the fact that they're sick. And, you know, he was in the ER with people. You got, you know, people were on planes, people this, that, and the other thing. It's looking increasingly like you've really got to come into contact with the stuff. You know, the way viruses work is they invade a cell, they convert the machinery inside the cell to convert all of its internal materials into viruses. Finally, the cell swells up and explodes, and millions or hundreds of millions of viruses go flying out of the cell. And that is happening, apparently, with Ebola, big time in the gut lining. So the stuff that people are barfing and the stuff that they are diarrhea-ing, that is really, really, really rich in Ebola viruses. Not so much their sweat or their tears or maybe their, you know, coughing and sneezing and things, because we're not seeing those routes of transmission here.
So, Tom, you're breaking up. I didn't hear a word you said. Can you hear me?
Really? Yeah, I can hear you just fine, Wayne. Crank me up 20 dB and let's just see what happens. Pop me up 20 dB. It's okay. Wayne, can you hear me now? How does it sound now?
No, I can't hear. I'm going to hang up. I can't
okay.
hear you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wayne. Good to hear from you. I don't know what's going on. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, you wanted to talk about nuclear power?
Yes, I'd like to talk about the big lie that nuclear power plants are carbon-free.
Right.
First of all, in the mining, the refining, the transportation, the guarding, the storage, the building, and the decommissioning of nuclear power plants produce a tremendous amount of carbon. And actually, a big 1,250-megawatt power plant produces the equivalent of 250,000 tons of carbon dioxide every year for life. But that's not touching the big picture. The big picture is that many nuclear power plants around America are grid-powered. In fact, for an example, the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant here in California is grid-powered.
All of them are grid-powered, Harvey.
Yeah, it's grid-powered, exactly.
Right.
It's fossil-powered, and to pump the 2.5 billion gallons of water a day from the plant.
Yeah, I interviewed Helen Caldicott for a half hour last week on this, and she said exactly what you're saying. You're spot on. You're absolutely right. Harvey, thank you for the call. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And don't forget, Bernie's at the Unitarian Church on Geary Street in San Francisco tonight at 7 o'clock. Drop by, say hi. Brunch with Bernie. And welcome back. Michael, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, I'm having a little breakup, too, but I just want to do a little sarcasm since it's Anything Goes Friday.
Okay.
Now, every day when I watch you, the backdrop shows the scaffolding around the Capitol getting bigger and bigger.
Right.
I think once the refurbishing is done, we should leave the scaffolding up to show our employees, the Congress, that their employers, the American people, work. So should they. What do you think, Tom? Thanks.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. The scaffolding kind of looks like a giant condom going up. I mean, wouldn't it be great if it could protect us from the Republicans? Michael, thank you for the call. Interesting suggestion. Victor in Lebanon, New Jersey, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind today?
Tom?
Yeah, you're on the air, Victor.
Okay. Small comment about David Hockey and what his wife was doing with whatever they were doing.
David who?
That's so crazy. It's not so crazy. I mean,
wait a second. Victor? Victor, can you hear me?
Yeah.
David who?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
David Hockey. This is your crazy alert a couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
It's not
You're talking about
crazy,
the guy with his, the guy and his wife who were into sex dolls. Okay.
But it's not that odd. It's not that crazy. People do it all over the world. There are a ton of companies that are doing it.
Yeah.
But that's not the reason I wanted to call. I was going to talk about Beijing and Hong Kong and Taipei.
Mm.
We got a problem. Hong Kong thinks it's not going to work. The protests are not going to work because not everybody is supporting them. The rich are not going to do anything. They're covering their own tails. The middle class or whatever they've got there is not going to do it because they're afraid. But the people are protesting, and thank God for them for standing up. But Beijing wants to vet their own candidates for chief executive, and they're going to put in their own stooge, and that's going to be that for Hong Kong. But now Taipei is having a rapprochement with Beijing, and this is going to be just like Hong Kong. It's not going to be a one country, two systems deal. They're going to end up with a problem. And it's because China's getting a big bully again, and they had an empire for 5,000-year history. And, they want to be an empire again. They want it back.
Yeah. Taiwan is a thorn in the side of the Chinese government, and they are particularly horrified, I think, by the fact that you have a multi-party democracy, a Democratic Republic in Taiwan. And once they've figured out how to deal with Hong Kong, I'm guessing that they will set their sights on Taiwan, and probably as the Chinese economy begins to slow down and, if they slide into a recession, which is almost certain, and in particular, if they hit a bubble, if their bubble bursts and they slide into a depression, then the pressure gets really, really strong. I mean, you look at the depression. Greece right now, over the last couple of years, has experienced unemployment rates and economic disasters equal to that of the Great Depression in the 1930s. And as a consequence of that, you see the rise of the Nazi Party in Greece. And I think that, something like that happening in China would push this aggressive right-wing nationalism that might lead to a war between China and Taiwan. And that concerns me tremendously. Victor, thanks for calling and bringing it up. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's so worth revisiting. I want to share this with you, and then I'll get back to your phone calls here on Anything Goes Friday. And it being Anything Goes Friday, you can pick up any topic you want. And so as, moderator's privilege, I'm going to pick the topic that I want, which is the FDR's Second Bill of Rights. This is what we need to do to reboot this country. It was proposed in 1944 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his State of the Union address. And he said, in our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. 1944, he's saying America is with us on this. We have figured this out. And he was largely right. I mean, he died shortly after this, and Harry Truman was not able to bring any of this stuff into fruition because in the election of 46, the Democrats took the Senate or took the House the Republicans took the House and the Senate and passed, Taft-Hartley, which gutted the right to work, produced these so-called right to work for less states. On and on. I mean, they just really started rolling back the New Deal. But FDR continues. He says these should be the rights that we have. Among these rights are the right to a useful and remunerative job. There's a well-paid job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. And keep in mind, back when in 44, when FDR was saying this, maybe 20% of America was farmers. It's now down to about 1%, but back then it was a lot. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. Isn't this more apropos to today than in the past, even? The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. Really? Health care, a right being proposed in 1944 in the State of the Union Address by the President of the United States? And we still have Republicans screaming about Obamacare. Oh, what? A right to health care? Are you kidding? Right. Welcome to Ebola land. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. Think about that for a minute. Most Americans live most of their lives in fear. I do not believe this is an exaggeration. The vast majority of Americans spend much of their life very seriously worried about the fact that a serious illness in their family or an accident that ends up, you know, paralyzing them or injuring them in a way that keeps them out of the workplace. Excuse me. Getting old and not being able to work, or unemployment. Just a serious recession. We've got millions and millions of Americans long-term unemployed. Excuse me. That we live in fear of these things because they're going to wipe us out. And FDR is saying the role of government is to make sure that you are not afraid of any of these things. That if you get sick, we've got your back. If you get old, we're going to take care of you. If you have a horrible accident, no problem. And he did this, by the way, with Social Security disability. And if you are unemployed, the government will provide you with a job. The government will be the employer of last resort, as we did throughout the Roosevelt presidency. Okay, so the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. Good education? Germany just abolished tuition. They just ended tuition in the German university system. Ended it. Nobody in Germany, no student who's going into college this year is ever going to owe a penny in student loans. Why? Because the Germans understand if you invest $10,000 or $100,000 in somebody's education, that person is going to pay far more than $10,000 or $100,000 in taxes in the course of their life in extra taxes because their income is going to be higher. They're going to be productive members of society. They're going to build the country. The Germans get this. The right to a good education. And then FDR said all of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, keep in mind, in the early winter of 1944, when he gave his State of the Union address, we were still at war with Germany and Japan. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. Remember, the United States is the only country in the world, or at least it was in 1776, I think probably, maybe still be, to list in its founding document, the Declaration of Independence, that one of the fundamental rights of its citizens was the right to happiness, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So FDR says, all of these rights spell security, and after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for all of our citizens. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're going to reboot our phone system during the break here, so if you've tried to call in or whatever and had a problem, just give us a shout back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where despair is not an option. And Ben in New York City. Hey, Ben, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you're familiar with Dr. Robert Cathcart?
No, I'm not.
Ah, okay. He was an associate of Linus Pauling.
I'm very familiar with Linus Pauling. I knew Linus Pauling when he was still alive.
Aha. Well, Dr. Cathcart was using intravenous vitamin C and mega doses of vitamin C to treat all sorts of diseases like AIDS and, cancer.
Right.
And he was recommending using mega doses of intravenous vitamin C against Ebola.
Okay. It doesn't work against AIDS. I mean, we know that. And I've known a number of people who had cancer and took high dose vitamin C. One of them had spectacular results. She had a thyroid tumor that had wrapped itself around her heart, was inoperable. It was metastasizing, and she did IV vitamin C. This was in Australia, actually. She did IV vitamin C, and this had been about 5 years before I knew her. Louise and I both knew her. And it had shrunk her tumor down to the point where it could be dealt with. But I've known other people who had cancer who tried IV vitamin C and still died of cancer.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, Dr. Cathcart was recommending starting with around 180 grams per 24 hours and then increasing the amount until you break the fever.
Right.
So
that's a massive amount of vitamin C.
Yeah.
There's a lot of speculation about how this works, by the way. In fact, I recall years ago having a conversation with Linus Pauling about it. And, you know, there's one theory that what it does is it shifts the acid-alkaline balance in the body, which makes the immune system more or less functional and makes the body a more or less hostile or friendly environment for pathogens. I think high-dose vitamin C has its place. For treating Ebola, I think that we're going to have to be looking for, it looks like this giving people serum from the blood of people who have survived Ebola, and thus they have, high levels of Ebola antibodies in their blood, seems like the way to go. And I think that we're probably within a year of a vaccine. Canada, which has a national healthcare system, is testing an Ebola vaccine right now. And I'm guessing now that there's enough Ebola out there that a company could make money on it. Probably other companies are doing it. So I think that's where we're going to go with it. But Ben, thanks for the call and thanks for raising the topic. Jerry in Long Island. Hey, Jerry, you want to talk about the Florida governor's race?
Yes, I do. And obviously something more important than a fan on the Charlie Crist's seat. That's so ridiculous for the media to focus in on that. There's more important issues. Yeah. And with respect to the Florida gubernatorial election, what I'd like to focus in on now, let me say for the record, I like Charlie Crist. If I lived in Florida, like my brother and sister-in-law, I would vote for him. But I do. What I fear is that he's making certain mistakes. And I know you like solutions. So let me identify the problem and then let me tell you what I think the solution should be. First of all, much like the George W. Bush versus John Kerry presidential campaign of 2004, much like that, what Rick Scott all this summer, what he got away with, is doing all these unresponded to political ads against Charlie Crist with little, if any, advertising pushback from Democrats. And so I think there's a part of the solution. I think at this point, the Charlie Crist campaign, first of all, should be, and it's my understanding they are not, but what they should be doing is directly answering these false Republican claims that Charlie Crist is a flip-flopper by saying specifically that although Charlie Crist may have changed political parties, he's never changed his positions on any of the issues, nor has he changed his opposition to both opposing the privatization of Medicaid. He's never changed his opposition to that, nor has he ever changed his commitment to serve all Floridians instead of just trying to serve the corporate special interests and the politically well-connected the way Rick Scott has been doing. In fact, Rick Scott has even given tax subsidies to corporations, even though they pay no taxes, like all Floridians. They've gotten all these tax subsidies. And the second thing that concerns me about the Chris campaign is that it's my understanding he's going to focus mostly on the Democratic base and Democratic voters to help get him elected, but he also needs to also focus in on progressive and moderate independent voters as well, especially since with respect to the Democratic base, I think they're a little bit distrustful of him because he used to be a Republican, then he became an independent, now he's a Democrat.
Right.
So I think they're a little bit distrustful of him, number one. And number two, the Democratic base is predicted to have a lower turnout than Republicans in the midterm elections, which is unfortunate. I think this is an important election all around the country, whether they're choosing a governor like they are in Florida, whether they're choosing a U.S. senator. This is an extremely important election.
Jerry, I agree with you on all points, and thank you for calling and making the. I want to let we've only got 20 minutes left in the show, and we've got a bunch of people who want to get in here. But, you know, good points all, Jerry. Well said. The thing that amazes me about the last 2 days of political coverage in the United States is that Charlie Crist did this, that Rick Scott did this back when he was running against Alex Sink. Alex Sink, Florida governor candidate accused of cheating in debate. Right? This is how Rick Scott won the election in 2010, was by saying Alex Sink, his opponent then, looked at a cell phone while she was debating. She cheated using an electronic device. He succeeded in changing the media narrative away from his insane right-wing positions to whether or not his candidate was a cheater. And he succeeded in doing the exact same thing with Charlie Crist. He's cheating with a damn fan. I was astounded last night when on MSNBC, even Rachel was responding to this, to talking about the fan. I kept waiting for somebody to point out that Rick Scott pulled this stunt 4 years ago and it made him governor. And he's doing it again. And the media is falling for it hook, line, and sinker just like they did 4 years ago. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening to KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, according to the Secretary of State of Georgia, 40,000 registered voters' names have been lost. Now, these guys don't play by any rules. We're dealing with organized crime here. The only allies that the American people have, as I see it, are whistleblowers, journalists, and hackers. And all three of them are at risk right now. And I would like for the hackers to stop hacking these department stores, working people, and grow up here and go after that Swiss bank that's got the 22,000 patriots who refuse to pay taxes, which would give us, the American people, some kind of leverage and some kind of tool to fight these guys. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. I would not recommend anybody break the law to do this. I think what we need to do is change the law. The federal government, our government, should be going after those people who have their money in the United Bank of Switzerland and other Swiss banks, and not just in Switzerland. We should be going after, you know, phony baloney banking in the Caymans, in the Bahamas, in Liechtenstein, in Luxembourg. I mean, it's countries all over the world that make their money in Panama, on super confidential banking, and they're laundering money for drug cartels and they're laundering money for American billionaires. And I think it's wrong, but you're spot on, Morris, in identifying a problem that needs to be addressed. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, you wanted to talk about the gubernatorial race in Florida?
Yes, I did. The gentleman that just called stole a little bit of my thunder, but what he doesn't realize is they are throwing $25 million behind Rick Scott, and it's really hard for Charlie, who was, in my opinion, was a very good governor when we had him as governor. He did some great things, early voting, ballots. I mean, you know, he's trying to protect our environment. He's trying to help our school. I mean, Rick Scott was just continually lying. He was making it up on stage, and Charlie actually went after him on one point and told him, that's not true.
Yeah.
And the problem we have with Florida voters here in Broward County, we're very blue, and they are just getting pummeled. You'll get 16 of those flyers in your mailbox versus maybe one from Charlie.
Yeah.
You know, the money is a big issue. And the last time we had a primary, only 13% of Broward County showed up to vote.
Oh.
And they just can't, you know, we need to get the word out. You know, your vote is important. Get in line. It's going to make a difference.
Yeah.
And it's hard to compete against the money. As soon as you cross over to the Boca line, boom, you are flooded with Rick Scott signs everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere. I'm talking trees.
Yeah. No, this is the power of money, and Rick Scott has hundreds of millions of dollars from his criminal enterprise, or his criminal days back at HCA and other sketchy ventures. And, you know, he's pouring his own money into the election, and as well at, which is what the Buckley decision in 1976 of the Supreme Court allowed, and it's how he got into the governor's race in the first place. And he's also got, you know, other right wingers and you know, all his crony corporations down there in Florida. The company's getting big tax breaks. The company's getting, you know, state subsidies. I mean, there is such a cozy little right wing, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours infrastructure across the United States that Republican governors, Republican candidates of all stripes have access to just breathtaking amounts of cash. And Democrats, you know, it's a real uphill battle. Linda, thank you for the heads up on that and for the report from Florida. Hopefully Floridians will see through this, and hopefully more of them will pay attention to what was actually said at the debate between Charlie Crist and Rick Scott versus Rick Scott's complaints that there was an electronic device on stage just like 4 years ago when I was debating Alex Sink. Let's only talk about that. Right. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More on Anything Goes Friday right after this. And welcome back. Jim in Miami, Florida, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hi. You have a wonderful show. I just got to see a little of it today. But can you hear me?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I got home and I saw your Bill of Rights. You were reading that about FDR.
Right.
And if people really want to know what's going on in the state of Florida, I'm for Charlie Crist. I attest to what your previous caller just said ahead of me. You're bombarded by literature for Rick Scott and very little for Charlie. But I turned on the news and it's in Channel 7, which is a Fox affiliate here in Miami. It was very interesting. They were giving a food away. The farmers of South Bay were giving a food drive for people who didn't have enough food. Well, lo and behold, do you remember those gasoline, lack of gasoline during the Jimmy Carter administration?
Sure, and the Nixon administration, yeah.
Right, I mean, yeah, right, correct. They showed lines, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cars for people waiting to get food.
Wow.
And this just goes to, there's going to be more of this if people don't get out and vote and really go for Charlie Crist. He's a good man, and that's all I've got to say.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well said, Jim. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Bruce, in Atlanta, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network, you wanted to respond to a caller about feeding the planet, Bruce?
Oh, no, sir. No, thank you for taking my call, Dr. Hartman. He mentioned about in his comments about saving the planet.
Mm.
And I thought, aha, there's the problem. We have the wrong mental processing. It's a mental processing flaw. We're not saving the planet. We're saving the human species.
Right.
And there's a weird disconnect that I think we need to roll ourselves as a human, as a species out of. If we're really going to do anything about anything concerning saving ourselves. Do you understand what I'm saying, Dr. Hartman?
I understand it perfectly, Bruce, and you're absolutely right. It's the old, it was an old comedy routine that was done by George Carlin, I'm pretty sure.
Was it George Carlin?
Yeah, about how we don't have to worry about saving the planet. The planet's going to be just fine. We've got to worry about saving ourselves. And you know, he was prescient, you know, spot on. You're absolutely right. So, Bruce, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. Got a minute to the break, Sanchez. What's up?
Oh, Dr. Hartman, real quick then. I wanted to let you and all of the Southern California listeners and watchers know about a movement called block the boat. This is concerning the situation. I know Gaza has fallen out of the headlines, but the situation there still continues. The people of Gaza are still suffering. We along the West Coast are called Block the Boat. We're a diverse coalition of peace activists and
boat with a B.
Yes, Block the Boat. In fact, hashtag Block the Boat Los Angeles is what I'm talking about here. Saturday morning at 6 a.m. at Pier A in the port of Long Beach, we will be gathering. We're estimating anywhere from 300 people on up to blockade one of the Israeli-owned cargo ships that's managed by Zim Integrated Shipping Services. It's the Zim Savannah that's bringing in Israeli cargo. And this is our attempt here in Southern California, along with the rest of the people in Oakland. They're doing a fantastic job doing that. Tacoma and Vancouver, who have all successfully blockaded the Israeli cargo ship that has been coming into port. And this is our attempt to break the apartheid state, which is...
So it's sort of what's good for the goose is good for the gander. You want to do a blockade? We'll do a blockade. That's very interesting. Sanchez, I wish you the very best. Thanks for the call. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our board op, Troy Miller, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Colley, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the companies that carry and syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program.
Thank you.
Excuse me. And I thought I could say that all without sneezing. Anyway, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mary Jo in Minneapolis, listening on 950 AM. Hey, Mary Jo, what's up?
Oh, yes. Hi, Tom. I've missed you because I've been out campaigning for Sharon Sund, S-U-N-D. She is our Democratic opponent against Eric Paulson, the very, very, very conservative Tea Party guy, who's our representative here in the 3rd Congressional District. And he has millions, and she has not nearly, you know, what he has in dollars. So she hasn't been able to get her name out there, her voice out there. But when I've been going door-to-door with people all summer, people are very against what Paulson stands for. So I think if people knew that she was, you know, in this election, they might get out and help us. We really need help. So we'd like people in the 3rd Congressional District here in Minnesota, where Eric Paulson is the representative, to please call her campaign office and let them know they're willing to help, either with a sign or with a donation or something. Could I give the number?
Sure.
952-582-4899. And Senator Melissa Franzen and I are giving a fundraiser for her on Tuesday. If people would like to...
It'll probably be much more effective, Mary Jo, if you give a website.
Oh, sure. www.votesharonsund.com.
F-U-N-D, Frank, under F-U-N-D?
No.
Oh, S-U-N-D.
Yes, as in Sam.
Sam, okay. So, or Sun, yeah. Sund.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
So they could simply go to sharonsundforcongress.com. And they'll get that, too.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great. Thanks, Mary Jo. Good on you for what you're doing. Keep it up. This is Jock in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KEBQ. Hey, Jock, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me on your show. I love your books. I just called to want to say that New Mexico polls are open. We voted today, and then we went and bought something called glass chalk. It's something you can write on the back of your windows. It says just married kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Except we wrote polls open, vote Democrat now. So please, people of New Mexico, the polls are open. Get down there and vote. And
there you go.
I just want to say thank you, Tom, for your book and your work and your radio program.
Thank you, Jacques. And thanks for the heads up on Albuquerque, on New Mexico. Cheryl in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Cheryl, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes,
sure.
I would like to
start a discussion about the integrity of our court. I have a website called respond2toB293121.com. Sorry, it's complicated. But I fear that we're talking about how corrupt our politics are and everybody else except the courts. And I would like to ask you, why do you think that is, and how do we get that discussion going?
The courts were one of the things that were explicitly targeted in the Powell memo back in 1971. And throughout the late 70s and throughout the 80s, the courts were aggressively targeted by right-wingers. Before the Reagan presidency, the vast majority of justices, of judges in the United States, were not elected. They were appointed. Now, or if they were elected, they were elected in totally nonpartisan elections. Now, I believe the majority of judges at local and state levels all across the country are elected. And the reason why the right-wingers have been working so hard to change state laws in state after state, or county laws or city laws, so that the judicial officials are elected rather than appointed, is because they can then go in and buy the election for them. It doesn't cost a lot of money, because typically these elections are not particularly expensive elections. And so if they drop a couple $100,000 into a judicial election and get some right-wing crank in there, then they know that when their company is brought up for killing somebody or polluting the water or the air or whatever it may be, this guy's going to, you know, or woman is going to vote in their, or is going to rule in their favor. And this is an issue that the trial lawyers are very, very conscious of, because it's getting harder and harder and harder to find a judge who will do anything other than dance to the tune of the billionaires and the right-wingers. America is... No, go ahead.
Well, it seems like people, I've been trying to bring attention to it with my website, and I'm asking people to vote no for Kenneth Yagan in the Second District Court of Appeals in Ventura, California.
Right.
But I'm surprised, because people don't seem to be interested in the topic. So I would love to see you have a show on the court system and try to get some interest from people and starting to talk about it.
We should do that. I think it's People for the American Way, the organization that Norman Lear founded, that has been, I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's People for the American Way that's been doing some really good reporting on over the decades on how the court, how our court system has become not just politicized, but basically corporatized. And it's a really bad thing for democracy.
Yeah, I would use the word corrupt.
Yeah, absolutely. It's corruption. And, you know, and much of it brought about, again, you go back to Buckley in 76, the Supreme Court allowing these kind of things. Cheryl, thanks for listening to KPFK. Thanks for the call. Spot on, and keep it up. Keep up the great work. It's been a great week. It should be a fascinating weekend. And I look forward to seeing you all on Monday. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, especially now. We're just a few weeks out from an election, and in many places around the country, you can vote right now. Check it out. Find out if you're eligible to vote. If you're not, please register to vote if it's not too late, and show up. There's important stuff on every ballot. No matter how insignificant this election may seem, there is important stuff to vote on. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.